From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Today, a gathering of doctors, first responders, and scientists in Washington discussed how to fight a smallpox outbreak if the disease were ever used as a biological weapon. Smallpox was eradicated in 1980, but before it was contained, it had claimed millions of victims. Those who didn't die were left permanently scarred. The first successful attempts at fighting smallpox came from two survivors during a particularly vicious 18th century outbreak, Lady Mary Wortley Montagu in London and across the ocean, Dr. Zabdiel Boylston in Boston. Neither had formal medical training. They took their cues from folk knowledge and customs from Africa and the Middle East. Despite ridicule and even death threats, both experimented with what we now call inoculation. Jennifer Lee Carroll has written a book about their efforts called The Speckled Monster, a historical tale of battling smallpox. She says their methods were crude, but effective.
What Boylston would do was go to a patient who had smallpox, and he'd dig out the pus from one of the pox and put it into a little vial, which he'd keep around his neck inside the shirt to keep it warm, because if you don't keep it about body temperature, the virus dies. So he'd then go to the patient, and pretty much like they do with modern vaccination, he'd prick the upper arm just enough so that a little bit of blood would bead up on the surface. Then he'd take as much of that pus, or matter as they called it, as would fit on the head of a needle, and rub it into that bead of blood, and then he'd bandage it up. Because it's live smallpox virus that they were using, this is a very dangerous procedure. So they're just waiting to see if this person is going to have a successful inoculation, which means that they'd have a very light case of smallpox. In a light case, all you'd get would be maybe a dozen pox, maybe up to about 50. Whereas in a case of smallpox contracted normally, which is thought to be by breathing it in, you could have as many as 1,000 or 1,500 pox scattered over your body. So inoculated patients would sort of sail through the disease with a very light case, and then the patients would be immune for their whole lives. Now, if he didn't keep the matter quite warm enough, or it got too warm, then they wouldn't get sick at all, and then they wouldn't be immune. On the other hand, and this was the really scary part, he did risk giving his patients full-blown smallpox.
And he observed this by watching African slaves in and around Boston. At around the same time, Lady Mary was in Turkey, where her husband was the British ambassador to the Ottoman Empire. And she observed much the same thing, but there the process was called engrafting.
Yes, they tended to use a lot of weird, rotten garden imagery. So it was widely practiced by Greek and Turkish women. The British firmly believed that it had come about in Circassia, which is in the Caucasus, because the Circassian women were some of the most beautiful in the area and stocked Turkish harems. And a lot of poorer families from the area would actually sell daughters into Turkish harems, and you can't sell your daughter if she's badly scarred with smallpox. So that's how the British believed it came about in the area. We don't really know. All we know is that it's in the folk medicine and that it was widely practiced by women and on women.
And Lady Mary subjected her son to this process. She had him inoculated.
She noticed, first of all, that this procedure was working because she spent a lot of time with her hosts in the women's harems in Turkey. Unlike other European women in Turkey, she did her best to dress in native clothing, spend time with the native women. And there's a great story of her walking into a bathhouse, and she saw 200 women in there. She was the only one who was clothed, so there was this moment of amazement when she walked in and saw these 200 naked women. But what she noticed is that, as she said, they had skin shiningly white. And basically she was comparing her own twisted, scarred red skin to these 200 women who had no sign of smallpox, which was an amazing thing. You wouldn't see that in Europe. So she started to ferret out the reasons why this would happen. She'd heard rumors in London of the practice of inoculation. And what she did was put together those rumors with the fact that it really appeared to work. And she was so convinced that it would work, and she was so terrified for her son's well-being, that she had the chief inoculatress come and inoculate her son.
She then returned to England and began to promote this practice at a time when Boylston was promoting this practice overseas in Boston. The two of them, how did they contribute to modern-day medicine and the way that doctors are now able to combat smallpox?
Well, Edward Jenner's really famous for developing vaccine, the modern vaccine, and he's generally credited as the founding father of immunology. What becomes apparent in this story is that he's standing on the shoulders of these two other people who were the first to develop inoculation, which is something that Jenner bettered. So what Lady Mary and Boylston did was kind of act as very important catalysts. They took folk knowledge from West Africa and from the Middle East. They brought it to the West and tried it against great public outcry and opposition. And they really forced it into very early Western science, where it was first studied and it first began to be practiced in a regular way with statistical follow-ups. And people could see that it really did work. So they had a share in the founding of modern immunology.
Lady Mary Wortley Montagu and Zabdiel Boylston, were either of them vindicated within their lifetime?
Yes, they were actually both vindicated, but Boylston, being a man, had a better chance at being publicly lauded, which he was. The Royal Society of London at the time was the most august body of scientists in the world. It's still one of the most august. And they wrote to Boylston and invited him to come to London and describe what he'd done in the epidemic of 1721. And then he was elected as a member of the Royal Society, a fellow. And that was in the 1720s, pretty much the equivalent of being awarded a Nobel Prize today. So he did have high public acclamation for what he had done.
And Lady Mary?
Lady Mary knew all of the same people who had invited Boylston to come. But the Royal Society was an all-male body. They would have nothing to do with a woman in their midst. Her acclamation really came in private. These men did respect her, but they pretty firmly told her, after they got their hands on this and she had proved that it worked, they pretty firmly told her to stay away. But she's primarily remembered for her writing, as she was then. And although she's never quite been forgotten as a great catalyst in the history of medicine, she's never really had great public honors before, no.
Jennifer, it's been great talking to you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Michelle.
Jennifer Lee Carroll is the author of The Speckled Monster, a historical tale of battling smallpox. You can read an excerpt from the book at our website, npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.